Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Only a Dream by H. Rider Haggard. Footprints, footprints, the footprints of one dead. How ghastly they look as they fall before me. Up and down the long hall they go, and I follow them. Pit-pat they fall, those unearthly steps, and beneath them starts up that awful impress. I can see a grow upon the marble, a damp and dreadful thing. Tread them down, tread them out, follow after them with muddy shoes and cover them up, in vain. See how they rise through the mire? Who can tread out the footprints of the dead? And so on, up and down the dim vista of the past, following the sound of the dead feet that wander so restlessly, stamping upon the impress that will not be stamped out. Rave on, wild wind, eternal voice of human misery, fall, dead footsteps, eternal echo of human memory. Stamp miry feet, stamp into forgetfulness that which will not be forgotten. And so on to the end. Pretty ideas, these, for a man about to be married, especially when they float into his brain at night, like ominous clouds into a summer sky, and he is going to be married tomorrow. There is no mistake about it, the wedding, I mean. To be plain and matter of fact, why there stand the presents, or some of them, and very handsome presents they are, ranged in solemn rows upon the long table. It is a remarkable thing to observe, when one is about to make a really satisfactory marriage, how scores of unsuspected or forgotten friends crop up and send little tokens of their esteem. It was very different when I married my first wife, I remember, but then that marriage was not satisfactory. Just a love match, no more. There they stand in solemn rows, as I have said, and inspire me with beautiful thoughts about the innate kindness of human nature, especially the human nature of our distant cousins. It is possible to grow almost poetical over a silver teapot when one is going to be married tomorrow. On how many future mornings shall I be confronted with that teapot? Probably for all my life. And on the other side of the teapot will be the cream jug, and the electroplated urn will hiss away behind them both. Also, the chased sugar basin will be in front, full of sugar, and behind everything will be my second wife. My dear, she'll say, will you have another cup of tea? And probably I shall have another cup. Well, it is very curious to notice what ideas will come into a man's head sometimes. Sometimes something waves a magic wand over his being, and from the recesses of his soul, dim things arise and walk. At unexpected moments they come, and he grows aware of the issues of his mysterious life, and his heart shakes and shivers like a lightning-shattered tree. In that drear light, all earthly things seem far, and all unseen things draw near and take shape and awe him, and he knows not what is true and what is false. Neither can he trace the edge that marks off the spirit from the life. Then it is that the footsteps echo, and the ghostly footprints will not be stamped out. Pretty thoughts again, and how persistently they come. It is 1 o'clock, and I will go to bed. The rain is falling in sheets outside. I can hear it lashing against the window panes, and the wind wails through the tall wet elms at the end of the garden. I could tell a voice of those elms anywhere. I know it as well as the voice of a friend. What a night it is. We sometimes get them in this part of England in October. It was just a night when my first wife died, and that is 3 years ago. I remember how she sat up in her bed. Oh, those horrible elms, she said. I wish you would have them cut down, Frank. They cry like a woman. And I said I would. And just after that she died, poor dear. And so the old elms stand, and I like their music. It is a strange thing. I was half broken-hearted, for I loved her dearly, and she loved me with all her life and strength. And now I am going to be married again. Frank, Frank, don't forget me. Those were my wife's last words. And indeed, though I am going to be married again tomorrow, I have not forgotten her. Nor shall I forget how Annie Guthrie, whom I am going to marry now, came to see her the day before she died. I know that Annie always liked me more or less, and I think that my wife guessed it. After she had kissed Annie and bid her a last goodbye, and the door had closed, she spoke quite suddenly. "There goes your future wife, Frank," she said. "You should have married her at first instead of me. She is very handsome and very good, and she has 2,000 a year. She would never have died of a nervous illness." She laughed a little, then added, "Oh, Frank, dear, I wonder if you will think of me before you marry Annie Guthrie. Wherever I am, I shall be thinking of you." And now that time, which she foresaw, has come, and heaven knows that I have thought of her, poor dear. Oh, those footsteps of one dead that will echo through our lives, those woman's footprints on the marble floorings, which will not be stamped out. Most of us have heard and seen them at some time or other, and I hear and see them very plainly tonight. Poor dead wife, I wonder if there are any doors in the land where you have gone, through which you can creep out to look at me tonight. I hope that there are none. Death must indeed be a hell if the dead can see and feel and take measure of the forgetful faithlessness of their beloved. Well, I will go to bed and try to get a little rest. I am not so young or so strong as I was, and this wedding wears me out. I wish that the whole thing were done or had never been begun. What was that? It was not the wind, for it never makes that sound here, and it was not the rain, since the rain has ceased its surging for a moment. Nor was it the howling of a dog, for I keep none. It was more like the crying of a woman's voice. But what woman can be abroad on such a night, or at such an hour, 1:30 in the morning? There it is again, a dreadful sound. It makes the blood turn chill, and yet has something familiar about it. It is a woman's voice calling round the house. There, she's at the window now, and rattling it. In great heavens, she is calling me. Frank! 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 She calls. I strive to stir and unshutter that window, but before I can get there, she is knocking and calling at another. Gone again with her dreadful wail of Frank! Frank! Now I hear at the front door, and half mad with a horrible fear, I run down the long, dark hall and unbar it. There is nothing there, nothing but the wild rush of the wind and the drip of the rain from the portico. But I can hear the wailing voice going round the house, past the patch of shrubbery. I close the door and listen. There. She has got through the little yard and is at the back door now. Whoever it is, she must know the way about the house. Along the hall I go again, through a swing door, through the servants' hall, stumbling down some steps into the kitchen, where the embers of the fire are still alive in the grate, diffusing a little warmth and light into the dense gloom. Whoever it is at the door is knocking now, with her clenched hand against the hard wood, and it is wonderful, though she knocks so low, how the sound echoes through the empty kitchens. There I stood and hesitated, trembling in every limb. I dared not open the door. No words of mine can convey the sense of utter desolation that overpowered me. I felt as though I were the only living man in the whole world. "Frank! Frank!" cried the voice with a dreadful familiar ring in it. "Open the door. I am so cold. I have so little time." My heart stood still, and yet my hands were constrained to obey. Slowly, slowly, I lifted the latch and unbarred the door, and, as I did so, a great rush of air snatched it from my hands and swept it wide. The black clouds had broken a little overhead, and there was a patch of blue rain-washed sky, and was just a star or two glimmering in it fitfully. For a moment, I could only see this bit of sky, but by degrees, I made out the accustomed outlines of the great trees swinging furiously against it, and the rigid line of the coping of the garden wall beneath them. Then a whirling leaf hit me smartly on the face. and instinctively I dropped my eyes onto something that as yet I could not distinguish, something small and black and wet. "What are you?" I gasped. Somehow I seemed to feel that it was not a person. I could not say, "Who are you?" "Don't you know me?" wailed the voice, with a far-off familiar ring about it. "And I mayn't come in and show myself. I haven't the time. You were so long opening the door, Frank, and I am so cold. Oh, so bitterly cold. Look there. The moon is coming out, and you will be able to see me. I suppose that you long to see me, as I have longed to see you." As a figure spoke, or rather wailed, a moonbeam struggled through the watery air and fell on it. It was short and shrunken. The figure of a tiny woman also was dressed in black and wore a black covering over the whole head, shrouding it after the fashion of a bridal veil. From every part of this veil and dress, the water fell in heavy drops. The figure bore a small basket on her left arm, and her hand, such a poor thin little hand, gleamed white in the moonlight. I noticed that on the third finger was a red line, showing that a wedding ring had once been there. The other hand was stretched towards me, as though in entreaty. All this I saw in an instant, as it were, and I saw it. Horror seemed to grip me by the throat, as though it were a living thing, for as the voice had been familiar, so was the form familiar, though the churchyard had received it long years ago. I could not speak. I could not even move. "Oh, don't you know me?" "Yet," wailed the voice, "and I have come from so far to see you, and I cannot stop. Look, look," and she began to pluck feverishly with her poor thin hand at the black veil that enshrouded her. At last it came off, and, as in a dream, I saw what in a dim frozen way I had expected to see, the white face and pale yellow hair of my dead wife. Unable to speak or to stir, I gazed and gazed. There was no mistake about it. It was she, even as I had last seen her, white with the whiteness of death, with purple circles around her eyes, in the gravecloth yet beneath her chin. Only her eyes were wide open and fixed upon my face, in a lock of the soft yellow hair had broken loose, and the wind tossed it. "You know me now, Frank, don't you? Frank? It has been so hard to come to see you, and so cold. But you are going to be married tomorrow, Frank, and I promised. Oh, a long time ago, to think of you when you were going to be married, wherever I was. And I have kept my promise, and I have come from whence I am, and brought a present with me. It was bitter to die so young. I was so young to die and leave you, but I had to go. Take it, take it, be quick. I cannot stay any longer. I could not give you my life, Frank. So I have brought you my death. Take it." The figure thrust the basket into my hand, and as it did so, the rain came up again and began to obscure the moonlight. "I must go, I must go," went on the dreadful familiar voice in a cry of despair. "Oh, why were you so long opening the door? I wanted to talk to you before you married Annie, and now I shall never see you again. Never, never, never. I have lost you forever, ever, ever." As the last wailing notes died away, the wind came down with a rush and a whirl and the sweep of a thousand wings, and threw me back into the house, bringing the door to with a crash after me. I staggered into the kitchen, the basket in my hand, and set it on the table. Just then some embers of the fire fell in, and a faint little flame rose and glimmered on the bright dishes on the dresser, even revealing a tin candlestick with a box of matches lying by it. I was well nigh mad with the darkness and fear, and seizing the matches, I struck one and held it to the candle. Presently it caught, and I glanced around the room. It was just as usual, just as the servants had left it, and above the mantelpiece the 8-day clock ticked away solemnly. While I looked at it, it struck two, and in a dim fashion I was thankful for its friendly sound. Then I looked at the basket. It was very fine white plated work, with black bands running up, and a checkered black and white handle. I knew it well. I have never seen another like it. I bought it years ago at Madeira and gave it to my poor wife. Ultimately, it was washed overboard in a gale in the Irish Channel. I remembered that it was full of newspapers and library books, and I had to pay for them. Many and many is the time that I've seen that identical basket standing there on that very kitchen table, where my dear wife always used to put flowers in, and the shortest cut from the part of the garden where her roses grew was through the kitchen. She used to gather the flowers, and then come in and place her basket on the table, just where it stood now, and order the dinner. All this passed through my mind in a few seconds, as I stood there with a candle in my hand, feeling indeed half dead, and yet with my mind painfully alive. I began to wonder if I had gone asleep, and was the victim of a nightmare. No such thing. I wish it had only been a nightmare. A mouse ran out along the dresser and jumped on the floor, making quite a crash in the silence. What was in the basket? I feared to look, and yet some power within me forced me to it. I drew near to the table and stood for a moment listening to the sound of my own heart. Then I stretched out my hand and slowly raised the lid of the basket. "I could not give you my life, so I have brought you my death." Those were her words. What could she mean? What could it all mean? I must know, or I should go mad. There it lay, whatever it was wrapped up in linen. Ah, heaven help me. It was a small, bleached human skull. A dream, after all. Only a dream by the fire, but what a dream. And I'm to be married tomorrow. Can I be married tomorrow? The Meerschaum Pipe by L.A. Lewis. November 17th. Never having tried keeping a diary before, it will be amusing to see whether I have enough mental energy to go on with it. At all events, my newfound leisure will not give me the excuse of being too busy. The only question about it is, shall I find anything worth recording in this quiet country existence? While it pleases me to begin with such a trifle as my own enjoyment in this property I have bought. And after all, I am writing for myself and not for others. My ability to retire and settle down at the early age of 40 is a cause of gratitude to the gods of chance, who gave me such rapid commercial success in the slump years when so many others were feeling the pinch. I just happened to strike the right propositions all the time, and now I can play the squire in my new domain and look forward to the idyllic life which next summer will bring fishing and pottering about these beautiful, unspoiled backwaters. Not that I despise the country and its pursuits in winter, being country bred, particularly in this fine old house. I shall find all the entertainment I need for the long evenings, sorting through the books and all the lumber with which it is stocked. And by next winter, I hope to have made friends who will come round for billiards or cards. Perhaps I may marry again, for Heronet should possess a hostess, but I fear I could never bring to another union the zeal of my first romantic attachment, so quickly ended in one of the London air raids. I feel myself lucky to have got Heronet at such a bargain price, and suppose it would have cost me a good few thousand more, but for the bad name it derives from its former occupant. After standing empty, however, for so many years, the dilapidation was great, and I could see how the agents jumped at my offer. It is rather strange how a house can continue to bear an ill repute from the misdemeanors of a tenant, even years after his or her death, though no doubt this place holds very gruesome associations for many of the local residents. One can excuse Harper his crimes on the grounds of his undeniable lunacy, but his reign of terror, conducted from here, must have been a ghastly period for the neighborhood, especially in view of the shocking mutilations he always practiced. Still, he died long ago in Broadmoor, and it is thought that the ground was cleared of all his victims. I have had the exterior entirely refaced, and I think Heronet may now claim to be purged of his influence. Well, I seem to be rambling on. A good start for the diary, anyway, if I can keep it up. Now I will close for today and spend the rest of the evening looking over my new possessions. November 18th. A bright day for the time of year, crisp and frosty. Had a call from the vicar, who asked, among other things, if I proposed to join the local hunt. Told him that I was no horseman, but hoped to do a bit of shooting when more completely settled. He then touched on the poor maniac, my predecessor, and I asked him if he thought the dreadful record of the place would affect my welcome in the village. He replied that he was sure the people in the other big houses would soon forget Harper, when they realized the hospitality of the new owner and saw how the whole estate had been cleansed of its former unkempt appearance. The villagers, though, would take longer to accept me to their confidence, and I must not be surprised if tradesmen refused to deliver goods after dark, as the grounds of Harrenay were popularly supposed to be haunted. He made his exit after inviting me to dinner next week, when he promised I should meet some of my new neighbors at the vicarage. I shall welcome the change from solitude, although my evenings here will not be dull while I have so many of Harper's belongings to look through. He appears to have had no next of kin, which accounts for all the furniture being sold with the house. Before his dementia overtook him, he must have been a man of refinement. His library is a book lover's paradise, and his personal knick-knacks and ornaments mostly of quite intrinsic value. While rummaging in the drawers of the study desk last night, I found a remarkably fine meerschaum pipe, which he must have smoked for many years to judge by the degree of coloration of the bowl. It has an amber mouthpiece set in gold, and is, in fact, quite an ornament. I intend to clean it up and give it a place of honor on the mantel shelf. My man can polish it when he starts on the china, as an ex-army batman, polishing is a hobby with him. Incidentally, I must consider engaging a staff of servants now that I'm about to meet new people. Johnson can manage quite well in a flat, as he had done for so long during my city career, but we shall need more than occasional daily help if we are to entertain as I hope to be entertained. That's all for today. I shall consult the local registry, if any, in the morning. November 19th. An irritating setback today. Called on Miss Sims, the postmistress, who acts as domestic registrar, and she promised to send round some applicants for my household jobs. Left her thinking the matter as good as settled, and stayed at home till lunchtime, but nobody called. Now she has rung up to say that she can find no one suitable at the moment. On reflection, I thought her a bit evasive during the interview, and am inclined to suspect the cause is all this superstitious rubbish the vicar mentioned. Suppose I shall have to get servants from elsewhere, but it is very ridiculous. My alterations had given the place quite a modern appearance, and there is nothing sinister about the grounds at night. Evidently the local proletariat keep dwelling on the secret burials that used to take place, and imagination has done the rest. Spent the earlier part of the evening thinking things over and planning for the future. I must seriously consider taking another wife. She might solve the servant problem more readily, and a hostess is really essential for entertaining married guests. But I don't fancy the notion a bit. Mary's memory is still too fresh even after all these years. Perhaps a lady housekeeper? Jobson has made a splendid job of the meerschaum, which looks, as I said before, definitely ornamental. I have a great fancy for this class of pipe myself, though I have never achieved such superb color in any of my own. I am, in fact, tempted to sterilize the stem of this one and see how it tastes. It should prove a ripe smoke. Has never occurred to me before to smoke another man's pipe, much less that of a homicidal maniac. But I think washing the mouthpiece with Lysol and scouring the bowl stem with a hot wire should destroy any possible germs. November 20th. I carried out my intention before retiring last night, and so enjoyed my smoke, that I felt disinclined for writing up any more of this diary. With a load of my favorite tobacco and a good fire in the study, the time passed like lightning. Really speaking, I think I must have dozed, though the meerschaum was still burning well when I saw by the clock that it was well past my usual bedtime. Today, I feel rather unrested, though I was sleeping soundly when Jobson called me. Most likely I have spent too much time indoors lately, browsing among the relics of Harper's tenancy. When I am getting daily fresh air and exercise, I never dream. But I am under the impression that my sleep was disturbed last night. Though I cannot recall any details, I shall take a walk around the grounds now and blow the cobwebs away before lunch. Later. My morning walk, very beneficial and brightened by parading my new acquisition, saw the vicar and Dr. Corbett, the local GP, passing my drive gates, and they complimented me on the color of it. As it made no reference to Harper, I took it they did not recognize it as his, and I did not choose to enlighten them. My ramble took me to a strip of waste grounds enclosed by shrubbery, and a walk where I am told two of Harper's victims were buried. Their trunks, at least. It seemed an ideal spot for murder, and I could almost enter into his distorted point of view, at least as far as the spice of secrecy was concerned. There must be a grim fascination in committing a crime that rouses the countryside and then watching the police go off on false scents. Harper went about his butchery for months without attracting the least suspicion. Evidently, he can have shown no outward symptom of insanity between the attacks, and must have exercised amazing caution in executing his horrible tasks. Yet his dementia was of an extreme kind, as was shown by the distorted artistry of his mutilations. Employed the afternoon and evening in a fruitless journey to the county town, 20 miles away, in search of domestics. Interviewed several candidates who happened to be at the registry office, but as soon as I mentioned my address, they made various excuses not to accept service with me. The popular aversion to heronry is very widespread, it seems, and it looks as if I shall have to engage my staff in London. Most annoying. Found some newspaper cuttings in the course of my evening's exploring among Harper's belongings. They all related to his criminal career, and I could picture him gloating over the horror which his monstrous recreation was instilling in the public mind. Having been abroad at the time, I was not well up in the history of this butcher, and so took the trouble to read the cuttings through. Apparently, he was actuated by no personal motive, but from a general lust to kill, and his victims were invariably women. The most revolting feature of the murders was his habit of severing the head and limbs with his sharp hatchet and leaving them on the scene for identification, while carrying away the trunk for addition to a sort of museum, which is supposed to have been kept in some room of the house. The subsequent interring seems only to have been effected when decomposition rendered it necessary, as the police deduced from the remains. November 21st. Another disturbed night, judging by this morning's lassitude. Though again, I have no clear recollection of my dreams beyond the feeling that they were of a distressing and even frightening nature. Also, I am convinced that I did, for me, quite an unprecedented thing. I noticed earth stains on my feet when getting into my bath, and Jobson found more of them on the bed linen, from which it is clear that I must have walked in my sleep. I have always regarded this as a sign of mental unbalance, so told Jobson. I'd gone down to the garden, fancying I heard an intruder. He must have wondered why I did not wear my slippers. But he is too well trained to offer such criticism. I've never had a day's illness in my life, and I do not like the symptom of nerve trouble, especially as I spent most of yesterday out of doors. I shall spend today on the links and get my lunch at the clubhouse. Later. A splendid game of golf with a member to whom the secretary introduced me, and another round by myself in the afternoon. I should sleep well tonight. Meanwhile, sensation has risen in the village by the discovery of a dead body in Arningham Woods. It appears to be a case of murder, the victim being a young girl from a gypsy encampment nearby. The postman told me that her throat had been cut, and that one of the hands severed at the wrist was missing. The last I take to be a piece of village gossip, originating in Harper's dismembering proclivities. I understand the affair is regarded as probably a crime of jealousy, and that the police are looking for a young basket maker who left the camp this morning. Enough diary for today. Just half an hour smoke, and I shall not want any rocking. November 22nd. Once more, a shockingly restless night, this time caused by definite nightmares. Though I fell asleep at once, and do not remember awakening till Jobson brought my tea, I feel as if I had been on the tiles. Most of the time I seem to be pacing endless corridors and clambering up and down stairs burdened by some weighty object which I was trying to conceal. What it was I cannot remember, except that it seemed both precious and repulsive simultaneously, and that I was in a panic in case anyone find me with it. I examined my feet on rising for any traces of sleepwalking, but could find no such evidence. One thing, however, puzzled me, namely that I appeared to be wearing different pajamas from those which I had gone to bed with. Still, most of my sleeping suits resemble each other, being all black silk and varying only in the braiding, so I may have been mistaken. Somnambulism apart, though, if these exhausting dreams continue, I must ask Corbett for a tonic. It will be a good opportunity to mention the matter if I can persuade him to a round of golf this afternoon. Later. I was wrong, it would seem, to start this diary wondering if I should find enough to write about in so rural a spot. The murder of the gypsy girl has now been followed by the mysterious disappearance of a cottager's daughter. By a coincidence, she is one of the prospective maids I interviewed 2 days ago, and although in service in the county town, was spending the weekend here with her family. Apparently, she went out for a solitary walk late last evening, and she has not been seen since, nor has she returned to her employer's residence. The discovery of bloodstains in a little-used lane near the village has, of course, given rise to a crop of ugly rumors, but as none of the girl's clothing or belongings has come to light, I see no reason to connect the two facts. Quite probably a case of elopement. I was about to close my diary for the day when Jobson entered my study in a great state of agitation. He had been taking a moonlight walk in the grounds near one of the boundary walls when he noticed some unusual object in a tussock of grass. Stooping to examine, he saw to his horror that it was a human hand. As he finished describing the finding of it, he produced the horrible thing from a roll of newspaper and laid it on my desk, when, overcoming my natural revulsion, I inspected it under a powerful reading lamp. Though no student of anatomy, I judged it to be the hand of a woman, partly, I dare say, on account of the cheap and gaudy rings which adorned two of the fingers. These baubles seemed in a vague way familiar, and I suppose that I had seen their wearer at some time in the village. Naturally, I rang up the police without loss of time, and have spent the last hour talking with the inspector, a very capable man who, as a young member of the force, was instrumental in Harper's arrest. He not only confirmed the rumor of the gypsy's hand having been cut off, but positively identified it with Jobson's grim find. He thinks that the basket maker, an unsuccessful suitor, must have taken the hand as a keepsake, and then, fearing to keep so terrible a reminder, have thrown it over my wall in his flight. This theory gives him a clue to the direction in which he was traveling, and the inspector spoke hopefully of an early arrest. November 26. The events of the past few days have occupied my mind to the exclusion of all other matters. My diary has been neglected, and I must recapitulate. So far from rustic uneventfulness, I seem to have landed myself in the middle of a grand Wignall play. A fresh series of crimes, identical with those of my perverted predecessor, has broken out in the neighborhood, and the surrounding country is teeming with police, pressmen, and morbid sightseers. By having the gates locked, I've been able to keep most of them off this property, but I caught two reporters astride the wall near Harper's Cemetery yesterday, and had Jobson turn them away. The village is in a state of siege, as no woman will venture out after dark, and even by daylight they go in twos and threes. A rumor that Harper had not died at Broadmoor, but has escaped, rapidly gained ground, and I found myself wondering if this were the case. The police, however, assure me that he died years ago, and that so far from any such escape being hushed up, a warning should be broadcast to all districts. Hard upon the heels of Jobson's discovery of the hand came news of a second mutilation during the ensuing night. The head, arms, and legs of Dr. Corbett's cook was found lying on a tombstone in the churchyard. The torso was missing. The night after, another woman's head and limbs were left neatly piled by the roadside not far from the assembly rooms. They must have been placed there in the early morning hours, as a local dance held there was not over till well after midnight. It is very disturbing to have this dangerous lunatic on one's doorstep, apart from the noisy crowd of sightseers who came to pry around, and even picnic on the sight of his crime. To add to all this discord, and perhaps resulting from it, my own health is causing me serious anxiety. It seems impossible for me to get a decent night's rest, even with a sedative that Corbett prescribed. My sleep is constantly broken by the most hideous nightmares, and one of which last night I even dreamt that I was accompanying Harper on one of his nocturnal escapades. The beginning of the dream remains utterly chaotic, but I distinctly remember standing in a field over the corpse of a woman whom he had dismembered. Though I could not see the man distinctly, he seemed to be constantly at my side, compelling me to busy myself, hiding the traces of his handiwork. As often, I believe, happens in dreams, when we do things as a matter of course that are completely foreign to our nature, I felt myself lacking all volition to resist Harper's influence, and in fact quite entering into the spirit of his requirements. I buried the woman's clothes in a ditch, covering them carefully with earth and dead bracken, and arranged parts of the body in a gate, balancing the head on one post and hanging the limbs in a row on the bar. The rest of the nightmare is like a fog photographic plate, save that I repeated my former impression of tramping great distances with a heavy burden, in this instance, a nude female torso. Such ghastly dreams must indicate some kind of ill health, and if Corbett cannot stop them, I shall consult a specialist. Later, Jobson has just come back from the village with fresh news, which to me at any rate appears horribly significant. Another woman's head and limbs have been found, balanced on a gate dividing two nearby pastures. Jobson's description corresponds unpleasantly with my dream. Is it possible that I am somehow spiritually in rapport with Harper's ghost through the medium of a common dwelling place? I've never imagined myself in the least psychic. And then, how explain the finding of an actual corpse, or at any rate parts of one, in view of Harper's decease? No, obviously a different maniac, but with similar tendencies, must be at large, and I do not see why the aura of Harper's possessions should bring me in touch with him, unless, perhaps, there's some malignant elemental native to these parts which prompts the killings, and which may, to some extent, influence anybody living locally. But this is too wild a speculation. I have never believed in such things. Jobson, by the way, found a telegram for him at the post office telling him of his sister's illness. He is a sterling friend and servant, so I told him that he must, of course, take a few days off to see her. He demurred at first on the ground that I should be unable to get local help, but I could see he really wanted to go. He has accordingly left to catch a late train, and I have the house to myself. November 27th. Another outrage last night, and another nightmare for me. This time it is Miss Sims, the postmistress, whose remains were found on her own counter by her daily help, who arrived to an early tea at 7 o'clock. The unfortunate woman can have had no chance to resist her attacker, as though she had neighbors on both sides. No outcry was heard. The trunk, as usual, had been carried off. Whether my nightmares had, again, any connection with this crime, I cannot recall. I am only aware of the sensation to which I have now grown accustomed, of carrying things about and of being a fugitive. Towards morning, however, I had an amazingly vivid dream, to the effect that I came down the stairs from an upper floor at present disused, entered the bedroom, and carefully washed my hands and feet at the bathroom, without, for some reason, turning on the light. This recollection came back as soon as I opened my eyes, and being convinced that I had been guilty of actual sleepwalking on at least one previous occasion, I went at once to the bathroom to look for traces of my suspected earlier visit. But nothing turned out to be disarranged, and I was left in doubt until, after preparing and eating a light breakfast, I decided to explore the upstairs rooms. One of the first things to catch my eye was a black tassel, similar to those of my pajama girdles, projecting from under a locked door. I remembered having seen the key to this door hanging in a cupboard under the main staircase, but on going to get it found it had disappeared, and I am now forced to a conclusion that I hate to face. Apart from the evidence of somnambulism, which in itself I resent as a weakness, I cannot overlook the connection between my dreams and the night butchery that is being enacted. Is it conceivable that in my sleeping state I have been actually present at one or more of these murders? An even dreadful thought, handled the dismembered cadavers? My whole mind shrinks from this theory, but it is otherwise hard to explain the subconscious urge to wash, the locking up of a possibly stained pajama suit, and the hiding of the keys. Good God, I must be under hypnotic suggestion, and if I am seen and recognized in this state, I shall be thought guilty of the actual crimes themselves. It has occurred to me that my bad nights may be due to excessive smoking, for I have lately been inseparable from my, or rather Harper's, meerschaum. To test this, I shall abstain from it tonight, and make do with a couple of cigarettes. November 28th. It is finished, and the meerschaum pipe is burnt in the largest fire I could build into my grate. I only write this last page of my diary for the sake of my next of kin, to assure them that, whatever my own condition, there is no hereditary stain. The pipe alone was to blame. When my writing is done, I shall go out into the grounds and shoot myself under God's clean daylight sky. I stuck to my intention of smoking nothing stronger than cigarettes, and for the first time in a week passed the early hours of the night in untroubled repose. Later, however, the restlessness must have returned, for a falling log awoke me to find myself sitting by the study fire, smoking the meerschaum. As I came to full consciousness, I experienced a sudden waning of an abstract horror. indefinable but intense. It passed so quickly, though, that within a few seconds I doubted its very existence. Everything seemed normal. The room was still comfortably warm, and I felt too wide awake to seek my bed at once. Instead, I said aloud and quite cheerfully, "Well, if my sleepwalking only brings me down here for a smoke, there's no great harm done." And as the meerschaum was drawn satisfactorily, I decided to sit up and finish it. If only I had suspected and burned the damnable thing then. An habitual smoker always derives a soothing effect from puffing at a pipe, and it was the marked superiority of the meerschaum in this respect that had attached me to it so strongly. Now, within a few moments, so pleasant a drowsiness crept over me that I heaped more logs on the fire, determined to finish the night where I sat rather than risk finally arousing myself by a journey back to bed. But if sleep came back, and it did heavily, it was not the revitalizing dreamless slumber that I wanted, but a fantastic string of the disjointed nightmare scenes in which I was constantly hunted from place to place by unseen pursuers and carrying in my arms a naked torso. At length, these visions gave way to a sort of silent, oppressive darkness, and that in turn to pictures of my own earlier life, so that I shook off the menace of the former and looked happily at sane and wholesome things. I forgot that Mary had long been dead, and thought that she lay beside me in our old room at Hampstead. She was asleep, to judge by her quietness, and I just awakened, but she lay very still in my arms. I bent my head forward, tried to touch her face with my lips, but it eluded me, and with an effort, I opened my eyes. I was back in my own bed at Harrowney, and of course there was no face on the pillow beside me. Yet, I did indeed hold something in my arms, down under the bedclothes, something that felt like the body of a woman, but was very cold and still. I slid my feet out of the bed sideways, without turning back the sheet. The missing bunch of keys lay on my pedestal cupboard, but I shall not belatedly explore that upper room. I know too well what it contains.